Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. This week is episode 213, and we are beginning Tress of the Emerald Sea, the first secret project from 2023 by Brandon Sanderson. Today, I am not only joined by Elliot and Paul, but Paul's lovely wife, Alex. Alex, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm really excited to be here.
Glad to have you. You are joining us because Tress, if I'm not mistaken, is your professed favorite Sanderson book. Is that correct?
That is very correct. It is my favorite.
Why?
I knew you were going to ask me this, and I knew that I needed to come up with a very good answer. And it keeps boiling down to, I love just the storyline, and I'll just leave it at that, but I also love Tress. I think Tress is just that you can even just see from the first couple of chapters, I just fell in love with who she was as nothing like super grand, but just really sincere, I think would be a good term for her. And I just was immediately just wanted to hear everything that she was going to go through. And she's just awesome. And then it was also just, it's a fun, whimsical book, and it feels different in a good way from some of his underwork. I mean, I love most of his other work too, but this was just different in a more, it felt more tailored for like my tastes.
When we started the, like when I started the book, I knew that this was Alex's favorite. And as soon as I heard about the teacups, I knew instantly that yes, this is her favorite book, and it all adds up.
I have a Tress teacup on the bookshelf behind me. Paul, how are you?
Wonderful. I'm feeling it's a lot of fun. I get to have my wife Alex on here, and so I'm excited. Reading Sanderson all together is something that we kind of bonded over even when we were dating, and so it's really fun to, you know, get to have her on the podcast. And of course, I'm always excited to start a new book with y'all. Back in the Secret Projects, I feel like I am used to Secret Projects, but really we've only read one. So I'm kind of withholding that, you know, that maybe I don't know everything about them. So I'm excited to get started.
Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I've been looking forward to finishing out the Secret Projects ever since we read Yumi. I really enjoyed Yumi. It was such a different book in the Cosmere that I immediately wanted to go and read Tress and Sunlit Man. But instead, we spent another year reading Mistborn, which was still great. I enjoyed Mistborn Air too. But having this gorgeous book sitting on my shelf, staring at me in the shrink wrap for over 12 months, more than, has been taunting me this whole time. So here we are, actually diving into it. I'm enjoying it.
I saw that you read ahead.
No.
What say you in your defense?
Nothing. It did not happen.
Uh-huh. My dear listener, Elliot read one chapter ahead, so he has more information than the half of us on the than Paul.
Than me. Yes. Everyone else knows what's going on. Elliot may have more information than just me, for the record.
Okay. Let's roll intro, and then I have one more background question for Paul and Alex before we start Tress of the Emerald Sea.
This is the part that the music plays. Like that. So, yeah.
I'm going to now include this. Paul and Alex, correct me if I'm incorrect. On your wedding day was the day that Tress of the Emerald Sea was delivered, and you displayed it at your wedding. Is this correct?
This is true. Yeah, I was hanging out with you, Trevor. The groomsmen were all hanging out, and then it came in. I don't know if it came in with other secret projects or just the one. I think it was just the one.
Just the one.
Yeah, and we had, part of our wedding, we had like a table of some of the books that mean a lot to us, and we just got to throw it on there. It was so beautiful. It was such a pretty book and matched like the aesthetic and everything. So yeah.
That is the nerdiest thing I've heard in a very long time, and I love it.
You didn't know they had a book display table at their wedding?
No, I think I did know about that. I don't think I recalled Tress of the Emerald Sea being on your book table. So that is fantastic.
Well, was it the original plan? I didn't know when it came. I don't think you even told me it came in until the next day. I don't think I saw it on the actual table, but like Way of Kings was on there, Narnia was on there. And so it just made perfect sense that Tress would be on there because I had read it by then and absolutely loved it.
Yeah. Okay. So we are covering chapters 1 through 8. There is no prologue in this book. When's the last book that you read from Sanderson that didn't have a prologue?
Yumi? Did Yumi have a prologue?
I assume Yumi didn't have a prologue because...
Must be a secret project thing.
Yeah, I guess not. So yeah, the answer to that is probably Yumi. Right off the bat, we have Hoid sitting someone down to tell them a story. And the story is Tress of the Emerald Sea, except that's not actually her real name, which is revealed to us in chapter 1. Paul, did you catch her real name?
I did. And it made me laugh. And I don't actually remember it off the top of my head, but it's a really ridiculous name. Yeah, go ahead.
It's Glorf.
Glorf.
How's Glorf. That spelled, Elliot?
It's like G-L-O-R-F. Let me double check that.
That sounds pretty straightforward.
Brandon should have really just gone with it and made it Glorf of the Emerald Sea.
Yeah.
Same art, same everything, but I think less people would have picked up the book.
So the line is her given name is Glorf, and it's a family name, but because of her hair, she's known as Tress, which made me stop and think, is Tress like a word? Do I not know this? What does Tress mean?
I'm so glad I'm here for you guys on this one, having long hair and can help with that. It's my understanding, I'm not 100% sure, but it's my understanding that tress is can also be used as a word for just locks of hair. So like tresses of hair, but I think specifically in her case, it's when you have long hair and it gets all tangled and you have that tress tangled kind of in that same, like I somebody like Rapunzel would have like tresses of hair, something like that. So yes, it made a lot of sense to me. So it's really funny hearing that you're like, is that a thing?
Am I the only one that didn't know this?
I thought it was like the name for those like pins that they put in their hair. That's what I thought a tress was.
You put a tress in your hair?
Yeah, like I have my tress in my hair. Yeah.
Okay.
You know. I didn't think about it until I read that line, and then I remembered the term. It's usually used like plural, like tresses, like her glorious tresses of gold or something like that would be something you'd read in like a Jane Austen book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So Glorf's hairy tresses earned her the name Tress, which I think is funny.
Yes.
Well, that's not a thing, but I'm just trying to be funny.
Which now that I'm thinking about it, we have 3 out of 3 secret projects where the name of the secret project is a title for a character, not the actual character's name.
Yeah, true.
Which I never thought about before.
Are you referring to like Nightmare Painter? Wait, yeah. What are you referring to?
Yumi and the Nightmare Painter, his real name is Nikaro, and they don't never use it. They call him Painter. Tress's real name is Glorf, and they never use it.
And then you have the Sunlit Man.
The Sunlit Man, he has... minor spoilers. He has a couple different names throughout that book, but Sunlit Man is not really one of them.
I know why he really picked Tress for her name. It's so that the acronym of the title, which, you know, people use all the time, would say Totes.
That's absolutely, you're so right. He was looking at the end and he was like, I've got Totes down, like of the Emerald Sea. You know, I'm going to make this best. And instead of goats, he went with totes, you know?
See, now that I think about that, goats is like way better, though.
Glorf. So he could have just stuck with
Glorf. Should have just gone with it.
Mm. These are the important questions on this podcast. Okay. First question. Alex, throughout the book, Hoyt is narrating as if he's speaking to someone else off, that like just off screen, but it's really that he's like telling you the story as a reader. Is that distracting for you, or did you enjoy it?
There were moments that I really liked it. I think there are some very interesting, fun Hoytisms. There were times that I did roll my eyes pretty aggressively at some of it, of just like, okay, I would just like to get back to Tress. But at least in the beginning, like these first couple of chapters, it is pretty fun, and I do enjoy his commentary on most of it.
Paul, with what you've read so far, do you enjoy it, or is it take away from it?
As of right now, I've enjoyed it and I'm really excited about it. Similar to Yumi, or so the recent books we've read, you know, there's books where there are Hoyt cameos, right? But this is like being told by Hoyt, and I feel like I get to speculate or draw conclusions as we go along just by the little tidbits and things that he says. And it kind of just keeps me more engaged. So I definitely like it. But it is like, at the same time, he is Hoyt and Wit, and he's really snarky and ridiculous. So it can be a bit distracting, but for me, it's a welcome distraction, I guess.
Elliot?
I like it here better than Yumi. And if you haven't figured out by now, we're going to be mildly spoiling the like format of Yumi, because we're going to be making a bunch of comparisons here. But I suppose we'll try and stay away from big spoilers, perhaps. I like it in Tress better because of my expectation going into this book and knowing the inspiration of the story. Yumi, I think it works at the end of the day. I think it broke Yumi for a few people. There were definitely some complaints out there. But in this book, it fits perfectly because I know that Brandon was inspired to write this because of The Princess Bride. And so if you go into this book thinking of The Princess Bride in your head, it fits perfectly. Like the scenes in the movie where like the kid and his grandpa are interrupting the scene to talk about something. It fits well with, you know, Hoyt kind of saying, and pause, let me explain that. Okay, back to the story. It just seems very much in that vein of a rather sarcastically delivered fairy tale.
Yeah, I agree. When we got the early chapters for Tress, which would have been March of 2022, I think
that's right. Yeah.
I think that's right. We didn't know that Hoyt was going to be a narrator until we were given the chapters. I remember reading it and absolutely loving the first five chapters that we were given in Tress. I was really excited. And when my son was born on January 4th of 2023. And so midnight in the hospital, rocking my son back and forth in the rocking chair, I was listening to Tress of the Emerald Sea, which had just come out 4 days previous. And I finished that book having like slept through half of it because it was on audiobook. And so like 2 months later, I had to go back and reread it like actually, because I got to the end of Tress and I didn't listen to the story half of it. But I really did enjoy Hoyt being the aware narrator. There's a term for that. Second person narrating? Something like that. Somebody tell us.
Yeah, I think it's like an
omniscient.
Yeah,
but
omniscient narrator or something like that.
He's speaking in like the second person. He's speaking to you as a reader, which actually may not be the case, because he's telling someone a story that's not us, but we're like witnessing the conversation, which is kind of odd. So the book starts. Tress, Charlie is the groundskeeper, in quotes, and by the end of part one, it's revealed that he's not actually the groundskeeper. He was fooling no one. He gets shipped off to the sorceress after failing to court on purpose 5 different princesses. The sorceress has him, and off Tress goes. Where do you guys want to start?
Should we start with some physics and science, maybe?
Sure. What do you got?
It's either that or romance, right? So I vote physics and science.
Yeah, I got bad news for you, Paul. if you're trying to avoid romance. Anyway.
I've been called out in our comments now for being a softy ever since marriage. So it's evident and it's true. And it's a really endearing book. So
you have come a long way since Dalinar Navani revealing safe hands on Dalinar's chest,
which I have been rereading Stormlight, and I still very much don't like those scenes. So nothing has changed with those scenes, but Yumi was really cute and sweet, you know, it was really good. And, you know, there's a lot of cute stuff. So it's different.
All right, Elliot, what's in the science corner today?
Oh, yeah. So some fun stuff happening on this planet, which I'm enjoying the fairy tale aspect of this. I'm fully ready to just immerse myself in the whimsy. Yeah. Ooh. Interesting whimsy of the world, but I'm also very interested in the science, in the physics. What's going on here? What magic systems are we gonna come across? Who are we gonna see? Where's all our Easter eggs? Those kinds of things. So immediately, I'm trying to think through how this planet works, and of course, the big intricacies of this world are the moons. It's got 12 moons. One of which for Tress, where we start, covers like a third of the sky, which is pretty cool.
That mental picture is awesome.
Well, and you don't even need to mentally picture it because there's some gorgeous art in the book, which does a beautiful job of showing you. But I remember seeing this first art piece, which just has a picture of Tress with her cup and the green moon in the background. They showed this at Dragonsteel back when we were there. And I remember looking at the picture like, oh, that's a really cool artistic exaggeration of a moon in the background. Well, lo and behold, it's actually not an exaggeration. The moon is literally that big and fills up almost the entire sky. So that was pretty neat. And then we also get this fascinating nuance of the moon is like raining down spores onto the planet. There's like these streams of spores coming down from the moon, and they create this ocean. So Tress of the Emerald Sea is apparently this entire ocean of green spores, which is fascinating. And I struggle with this to start with, because when I thought of spore, I think I incorrectly imagined like a big fluffy tuft of like a seed pod or something that a tree would drop. So I'm thinking of like these big, I'm thinking of, so in Colorado, we have these cottonwood trees and they drop this like little fluff of cotton that like floats in the wind. That's what I imagined when I thought of spore, but that's very incorrect. This is much smaller. It's like sand. There's this sand that's everywhere.
Well, that's interesting, because when I heard spore, I thought smaller than sand. I thought like cell, like an amoeba. Mm-hmm. Which is also incorrect. So I don't know where I got that from.
I was similar to Elliot of thinking kind of along the lines of sand. And I was trying to wrestle with it's like a weird semi-solid surface or something. Uh-huh. It's you're right. The physics of it are a bit odd. It's like a solid liquid. Not a liquid at all, actually, but
yeah.
A bunch of solids, a bunch of little beads.
And that's where I really started to get intrigued, when they started describing the ocean and how it's a sea of sand, but it has some kind of air or gas flowing up through it. And I started to like maybe try and go Google search something, and then Hoy just explains it to us in one of the chapters, and explains how it's the phenomenon of fluidization, where if you pass a gas in a steady stream through a solid, it actually will behave like a liquid. And I thought about doing a long, detailed, boring explanation of the physics and science behind that, but I don't have to because Brandon Sanderson already did. He posted on his YouTube channel a video that I just got to watch for the first time that I'm very excited about because he did a collaboration with Mark Rober, who, if you've not seen Mark Rober's YouTube channel on YouTube before, your day's about to get a lot better. Go search Mark Rober's YouTube channel and watch some of his videos. They are some of the best on the entire internet. And Brandon and Mark explain the concept of fluidization, and they demonstrate it on his desk in Mark Rober's workshop with sand and air and how it works. And they push little balls and things across the top of it and show exactly how this concept works and how you could make an entire ocean out of this. And it's phenomenal. Go check out that video. You do not need to hear me describe it because Brandon and Mark do a way better job.
If somebody's listening to this and they have not heard of Mark Rober and digested his entire library, I envy them because they get to go watch Mark Rober for the first time. I was initially like turned away by the idea of like a sand ocean, just like very odd to me. But as the story goes on, you kind of just, I kind of just forgot about it, and it just, the ocean acted like an ocean. Paul, teacups. What's going on with the teacups?
They're definitely fragments of one Dawn shard known as the tea shard.
Okay.
And I'm not supposed to know that yet because people know I've got really good predictions and I just have a kind of a sixth sense for this whole thing. I mean, I've made lots of correct predictions.
I'm still trying to get over the Shallan and Lightsong one. Just
yeah, I mean, like I said, it's kind of a sixth sense. I'm very fortunate to have such a special gift. But in Trust 2 is when that's going to be confirmed. Trust
2.
Yeah. When Trust 2, Trust Strikes Back, that's when it's all going to come together for that. So,
the return of the Emerald Sea.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Alex, which one's your favorite cup? She ends up with four by the end of this episode and one broken one. So she has I don't remember what the first one is. Actually, she has five. The first one she gets with Charlie still on the island has Irriali writing on it, which we'll come back to here in a second. The first one she gets from Charlie. Ooh, I don't actually remember this one, so I'll skip it. The second one she gets is red. It's like red glass. It's like a really tall, thin red glass. Third one is a pewter tankard, like you'd see at a tavern. And then the fourth one I am holding in my hand is a green butterfly flying over the Emerald Sea. What's the first one? I don't remember.
Wow, Glorf gave you that personally?
No, I bought it from Brandon Sanderson himself at Dragonsteel for $35. Wow.
Incredible.
One of them's wood, I think.
Wood? Is that the first one?
It's going to take me a while to find it, so I will try to confirm. But I think I recall one of them being wood.
Well, my favorite... The problem is I like all of them because the entire concept of the teacups and her... The reason why she loves teacups and then the reason why he sends her teacups, I'm kind of just a fan all the way around. I think for aesthetic purposes, I like the butterfly one. For story purposes, I think I actually like the broken one just because of, I don't know, just the hopeless romantic in me is like, he still tried to send one and it was just a beautiful... I am such a sucker for that. And so I think that I like the broken one because it's just, he tried.
Yeah. That one I believe is porcelain, the one that broke. I still can't remember that first one. That bothers me.
It actually says the first one is a beautiful porcelain cup without even a single chip. And then it doesn't describe it anymore.
The pure tin cup that she gets while Charlie is still on the island, which this was actually kind of like or maybe it still will be, like a misdirect. I thought when the first cup was like tin and then the fourth cup was pewter, I was like, oh, okay, we're going down a Mistborn route. That's really cool.
She's an Allomancer.
Yeah. She's secretly like, you know, she can burn iron and doesn't know it or something like that. And once she gets an iron, you know, maybe that'll happen. It won't. But the first all tin cup has Irriali writing on it. Alex, when you read this book, had you read Stormlight yet?
Stormlight, yes.
I haven't read at that point Rhythm of War.
Okay. So this is a direct Stormlight reference. Elliot, did you key into this?
Oh, of course. I'm definitely on the hunt for any crossover material I could find, and mention of Irriali immediately stood out. There's not a lot. It seems like a bit of an Easter egg. There's not too much to maybe glean from it. Although they do describe, I can't remember if this is Hoyd narrating or if this is actually the characters in the story, but they talk about how the Irriali used to live on an island and then they vanished, which...
That's Charlie speaking, yeah.
Oh, okay, so...
Charlie gives a little bit of a history lesson on the Irriali.
So the characters in the world, they even know that, which just adds more evidence to this nomadic nature of the Irriali and the fact that perhaps they pop onto planets and then leave and move on after a period of time.
This was maybe the number one thing I wanted to ask y'all about. What is the time, Cosmere time frame for Tress? Because in my head, is this where the Irriali were before Stormlight happens? Is this like where they went? Because, you know, they reference that whatever they got here years ago and they'll have to leave years ahead or something like that. Is this where they were before, or is this like a distant future thing?
I'm not telling.
Will I find out by the end of the book, or will you tell me by the end of the book?
I will tell you by the end of the book.
Okay. I can live with that.
Alex, do you know about the Irriali showing up in random places around the Cosmere?
No, I do not.
They have a cameo in Mistborn Era 2. And I think that's it. This one, Tress, Mistborn Era 2, and obviously Stormlight is where we know them from. But well, there might be another one.
We read a preview chapter.
Yes.
That talks about it. That's all I'll say.
Yes. We do have a preview chapter that we're not allowed to talk about.
Yes, that's true. Which is kind of integral to this, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay. The magic system. Salt and silver halt the killer. Any slant rhyme fans here?
No.
I'm a big slant rhyme fan.
No.
Have some fun. I think it's fun.
Especially when you have someone like Michael Kramer delivering that line and trying to make it rhyme as much as possible, I think it's enjoyable. Elliot, why salt? We know what? About silver. Why salt?
Yeah. We're somewhat familiar, at least, or we think we're familiar with our metals now. We've read Mistborn. We've read stories like, help me with the super long name. Silence, no.
Shadows of Silence in the Forest of Hell.
Thank you. That one.
Dang.
Where we learn about the effects of metals and investiture and things like that. So silver doing something weird with your magic system. Yeah, definitely. I'm all on board with that. Makes sense. But why salt? Why salt? What is going on there with salt? I mean, salt can just kill things straight up. You go bury your garden plant in salt, and I don't know that it's going to survive. So maybe it's just a literal, like the spore is a living thing and the salt kills it. No magic needed kind of thing. I don't know. The salt seemed out of place.
I actually thought the salt was... See, this is also me coming in, not always looking and like diving deep the magic system. I read this before I read Mistborn, and really I had read a few of the Cosmere books. And so in my mind, salt was one of those things that you that people would put on like meat to keep it from getting bacteria and
right.
going really sour and really rancid. Yep. And so to me, it just kind of makes sense of like, yeah, keeps it clean. And I just, I like you were saying of just, it helps keep things clean because it's a fresh living thing. And I was just like, oh, I didn't know about the silver. The silver would probably what I have more questions on, but now reading, knowing where I am, it makes a lot more sense in the Cosmere. But salt, I was just like, makes sense. It's a clean thing.
I mean, personally, I mean, I would hate to get assaulted, so.
Oh.
So, I think it's pretty menacing, honestly, compared to many of our magic systems. So, so I think it's, I just think Brandon hit a home run with this one. So, yeah.
How long have you been premeditating that joke?
You want to know the sad thing? I didn't remember that salt was related to the magic system at all until Trevor just mentioned it. So that was fairly off the cuff. I did catch the silver, and I've had a lot of questions about spores, but I didn't actually remember about salt specifically. I think they mentioned like salt crates or something on the ships and things like that, but I just assumed it was practical purposes. Of practical uses of it.
So Diggin's Point, the island that they're from, I believe has salt mines on it. It mentions mining, like it's a mining island, and I believe they're mining salt. I could be wrong about that, but all the ships have like silver in them, like kind of veined throughout the deck and the railings and stuff like that. They have salt in like all their food to make sure it doesn't have any spores in it when they eat or drink it. So, salty tea.
I was going to mention the salty tea. So I'm a tea drinker. I love my tea. I've got a cup of tea right here, but salty tea, that sounds absolutely disgusting. You know how, when you get like, you go to the ocean and you're having a lovely day at the beach and you're swimming around, and then all of a sudden like that rogue wave comes out of nowhere and slaps you in the face and you get a mouthful of seawater. Ruins the rest of my day.
Yummy.
You've got that salt flavor in your mouth, and it's just gross. And Tress is sitting there drinking a cup of salt tea. Gross.
That's why people are most likely to get dehydrated or die of thirst on the ocean, because if you drink seawater, it's more dehydrating than hydrating because of all the salt content. Mm-hmm.
So Charlie gets captured by the sorceress, or delivered to the sorceress by his father. Tress decides to go save him. That's the end of part one. Five chapters. We're into part one. And then we're covering through eight. So Tress successfully gets off the island. So let's talk really quick about how she does that. Her father had a mining accident at some time in the past and has trouble walking, has like a walking cane. And when he was able-bodied, he was well known in the town for helping you with anything that you needed. And he'd be there if you needed to, you know, help build your house or, I don't know. In chapter seven, they go through all the favors and stuff that he's earned and been owed by the village. And so he cashes them all in this tavern scene in chapter seven. And I just wanted to highlight this because I really enjoy like a good like mother and father. What's the word I'm looking for?
I also enjoy a good mother and father.
Man, now I have to keep this in. I was going to cut it, but you.
Sorry.
Trevor. I forgive you.
I can build on your point, and you can think about what you're trying to say.
Yeah, go. My brain is gone.
Go ahead, Elliot.
My incomplete sentence will remain incomplete.
The note that I took down was, it's actually chapter six where Tress goes and pitches her idea of going to save Charlie to her parents. And it, like, spends the entire chapter of her trying to convince her parents. She makes pies. So Tress makes pies for everyone whenever she's trying to get something, which the life lesson I've learned already from this book is if you need something, make somebody a pie first. What I took away actually was almost, it's almost unique in and of itself to have the parents be supportive of the hero. I mean, think
about
it. That's
what I was trying to say.
Run through all in your head, all of like the heroes from the big tales you can think of. Half of them are orphans. The other quarter, another quarter, like the parents are villains. It's the parents are suppressing the child or holding them back. And the child has to like, or the son or daughter has to kind of break free from the oppressive parents to go do the thing they want to do, to actually have both parents in the picture, fully supporting Tress in what she wants to do and like launching her off on a quest. You don't actually see that very often, which actually makes it unique as simple as it is, which I thought was kind of cool.
One of the things that I appreciated in their support was it wasn't just like a, oh, you're our daughter, we'll support anything you say. Like there was logic behind it of like, well, knowing her and knowing that this is the decision that she's come to, we know that this is the best decision, even if we don't support it. And then one other little extra thing I just want to add, that this is an excellent reason of why this is one of my absolute favorite books, is the intentional whimsy of them being like, and it, the dad had, I'm summarizing, like the dad had two pies because this was a two pie problem, but also it could be a half pie problem. And I was like, I relate to that because it goes either way on if it's a two pie problem or a half pie problem. And so I really appreciated that little tidbit in there. But then again, how they came to support Tress and be like, okay, based on how we know she is as a person and how much we respect her as a person, we know that even if we don't support this, like even this isn't what we want for her, we know that this is the best decision because that's where she came in. That's the way her decision, this is the decision that her thought process got her to. And I thought that was a cool dialogue from her dad too.
Yeah, this is the conclusion she came to. So we'll support you because you're more thoughtful than we are. So that's mm-hmm. how he came to that.
Chapter 7 in particular, I really, really enjoyed. So chapter 7, Trevor, you mentioned already, is the scene where her father kind of goes and cashes in all his favors to get Tress the help that she needs to sneak off the island. And after I read the chapter, I kind of got to them and was like, wow, that was not a typical Brandon Sanderson chapter. And I went back and reread it, trying to figure out why. And I realized the uniqueness about that chapter is there's hardly any dialogue. Brandon is a really, in general, dialogue heavy writer. He tells the story through the eyes of his characters. And so you're usually learning about what's going on through what the characters are doing or what they're seeing or what they're talking about. There's like three lines of dialogue in all of chapter 7. And yet it's also not just an expository chapter. He's not just telling, like explaining, and then her father walked to this place and then that. He has this really fascinating way of tying all these metaphors together and talking about how, like my favorite line from it was Lem, her father's name is Lem. Lem was not poor. He simply didn't have a lot of money, and then kind of weaves that metaphor throughout it of how rich he is in friendships and relationships that he has. And they never actually say Lem went and cashed in all his favors. But by the time you get to end the chapter, you realize that's exactly what happened as he's going and talking to all these people. It was just really well-written chapter.
I think the chapter opens with Tress's father was wealthy, and then Hoyd backs off the story and says, now you might be thinking, wait a minute, Hoyd, everything I've read so far has told me the opposite. I think that's a great,
doesn't point. It say something, this may be in a different spot, but it says something of like, I thought I said something like Tress's dad is poor, but not that he's poor. He just has no money or something like right. that. It doesn't mean he was a poor man. He just didn't have much money, you know?
Right.
But it talks about all the other things that he has, you know. And I thought that was pretty funny. I will say it's really fun coming to this, secret project book. Like Elliot was saying, the chapter just being really well written. I feel like we're just getting to really read and experience Brandon Sanderson. And just, you know, we recently read Mistborn, which was an earlier work, and then we read Elantris. And it's really cool seeing, I feel like, how he's improved just as an author. And it's just really just so pleasant to read the Secret Project books specifically. It just feels super fresh and new and really good. So yeah, it's just really nice.
I'm actually really excited for Sunlit Man now. I'm so excited to finish this book, but I'm thinking ahead to Sunlit Man because Yumi, that these secret projects, you can really tell Brandon is kind of letting himself go. He's letting himself really kind of explore what he's capable of. He's not worrying about catering it to a certain audience. He's just having fun. And you can tell in the way his prose just kind of flows from one thought to the next. And in Yumi, it works really well because that story is all about artistry and beauty. And so that flowing nature of writing kind of works. In Tress, the vibe I'm getting so far is this very like almost silly story. And so you've got this kind of goofy jump around to random things vibe, but Sunlit Man, I don't quite know what to expect in that book, but I'm kind of expecting something a little more serious. And so now I really want to know what is Sanderson Unleashed, but serious going to look like.
You will not be disappointed.
I'm excited.
Alex, have you read Sunlit Man?
No, not yet.
I think for both of us, that's the only thing that we haven't read now. Once I finish this, as far as Cosmere goes.
So Brandon said when Sunlit came out that it was intended to be read before Stormlight 5. And because it's Stormlight adjacent. And I'm not sure I super agree with him. Christian on the Lost and Roshar podcast put it this way. As Christian was reading Sunlit Man, he said that he wasn't sure that order was going to stand the test of time. That do you really stop for Sunlit Man when you have the full Stormlight archive? Like, is that like once you have books 1 through 5, why would you stop for Sunlit Man if you're, you know, recommending the series to someone? And I agree with him. There's obviously cool insight in that book, which we'll get to in about 2 months or so. But yeah, I would encourage you, Alex, to read it before Stormlight mm-hmm. 5 comes out, but it's not required, I don't think. So
I've already told her that I'm requiring that we both read it before Stormlight 5. So we're trying to go to Dragonsteel with no apprehension or worry of spoilers, you know, unless people start talking about other Brandon works, you know.
Because I got to go with you guys last time, but I was a novice when it came to the Cosmere. I read four books, three of them being Stormlight, one of them was Warbreaker. And so I went in knowing I was going to get spoilers, but trying to avoid it. And so, like, you guys would go to fun reveal things, and then I couldn't go, which was fine. I got to go do other fun stuff, but I was specifically trying to make sure I am completely caught up in the Cosmere and everything so that there are no spoilers. I know them all, except for obviously the fifth one.
All right, Alex, I'm going to try to get you to share in my joy of this podcast. Paul, I need your best prediction of this book and let Alex and I laugh at you as you are incorrect.
Well, that won't be too hard, Trevor, because as we've previously discussed, I'm excellent at these predictions. Absolutely astonishing.
The word I would use, Paul, is ambitious. You are ambitious with your predictions.
That's honestly, Trevor, thank you. I really needed to hear that. That I really appreciate that a lot.
I'm glad you took it as a compliment.
Yes. We've gotten with books that we've read lately, or more. I'll just say the newer books, right? We were reading in Mistborn Era 2. We read Yumi, stuff like that. I want a new shard. I think there's going to be a new shard, but right now I can't point to it. If I had to guess, I'd guess Whimsy, because we haven't met Whimsy yet, I believe. So I think that'd be really fun. It's an interesting book to make predictions on, because we know that Brandon Sanderson wrote this to be what might would happen if in The Princess Bride Buttercup went after the guy. Like that's like the premise. Wesley,
right?
Yeah, I didn't remember. And so I'm like, I know how that story goes. So I'm expecting similar tropes. I'm expecting the kind of like three guys, like three tests or something like that as a fun nod, like the giant test of strength or something. It may not be Tress doing it, but I'm guessing that there's going to be some fun nod to that, because that's such a classic part of The Princess Bride. As far as like bigger things, I think we're going to see a shard. Maybe it's going to be a dragon, because I think they reference dragons and stuff. And so we might do that. We might meet our first one, which would be my hope. That's my very selfish hope, is that we're going to like, maybe Tress will become a dragon. I don't know if that's possible, but that'd be awesome. Yeah. Like Maleficent.
That sets you up well for Tress 2.
Yes. Yes. Tress 2. Yeah. And she's just like a dragon. That'd be awesome. Yeah. I'm hoping for, honestly, you know what I think would be really cool? I'm just thinking of this on the fly. Hoyt is our narrator. I don't remember. So he has a lot of like one-liners and things like that. I think it'd be neat and sneaky of Brandon Sanderson to sneak in a really big one-liner like reference where he's just like, yeah, also, I don't know, Kelsey is here because he goes everywhere or something, you know, something like that. Or so some other like offhanded Hoyt mention later on, I think would be really neat. And I could totally see that happening. I think that's realistic.
All right, Elliot. One plot prediction and then one like wider Cosmere prediction. What are we going to, something we're going to learn about or get revealed like a shard, like Paul was saying.
I feel like this book is more challenging to predict than others. I get the vibe that he's trying to be unpredictable, that the book is meant to be a crazy fairy tale that you don't know what's going to happen. So I think in the back 25% of this book, so like Sander Lanch territory, I think it's going to get wild. And not like earth shattering, armies clashing, you know, Oathbringer wild. More like we may not end this story on this same planet wild. I think we might get a large, like surprising twist where I like Paul's thoughts of Tress not ending the story as the peasant girl that she starts it as something maybe kind of ridiculous, like, yeah, a shard, a dragon, a vessel,
maybe we'll get another Dawn Shard.
Avatar. Dawn Shard, sure.
Yeah. Paul really wants to learn about more Dawn Shards before Stormlight 5.
Absolutely. Desperately. Please. I'm hoping that all my questions about Dawn Shards will be answered in Tress and Sunlight, because that's all we've got left. So, yeah.
Running out of time.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I'm probably not being specific enough for your prediction, but I think Tress is going to either like leave the planet, do something crazy, become something crazy, ascend to godhood. I mean, we've seen it before. I think this story is going to take a wild turn because it just feels like the kind of story we're on. Larger Cosmere implication. That's an even tougher question, because what I really want this book to be is a new entry point to the Cosmere. We've talked about this. It's been a while since we talked about this, actually. But one thing I'm on the lookout for in this book is, can I hand this book to a brand new Cosmere reader? Can I say to someone who's not ready for a Stormlight, who maybe isn't going to vibe with Mistborn Era 1, can I say, start with Tress? I'm curious what my answer is going to be to that question at the end. And if there are giant, huge Cosmere impacts by the end, I feel like the answer to that's probably going to be no, which I kind of don't want that to be the case. So my hope is almost that this is a little more standalone and not quite as Cosmere crushing as some other stories might be.
Alex, would you hand this to a Cosmere newbie?
I would.
Okay.
I don't know if that's fair because it's my favorite, and so I want everybody to read it.
Sure. That this discussion was big last year when all the secret projects came out. We, like, plenty of people were hoping for a new place to enter the Cosmere, and we'll get to it. But there is one specific reason, literally one line in one book, that would make me hesitate to hand this to a new reader. As a general rule, yes, I would definitely give this to someone being introduced to Brandon Sanderson. But there's one line that's kind of a killer, which we'll get to. You'll know it when you read it.
I remember you referencing this earlier. Like, I don't know, we were just chatting sometime or something, and you said you really thought about having me and Elliot go ahead and read it, but literally, like, cross out or like one line of the book, just completely black it out because we hadn't read whatever it was, whatever reference it was to. And I still think that's really funny. I feel like that'd be a really funny way to do it, is you could give this book to someone, but it's your, like, the spoiler-free version, and it's just missing that one sentence or whatever.
Yeah, a little bit of whiteout.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. We can close it there. I do want to do a bit of Stormlight review and call it rigged, but Alex, you can join Paul if you like to help him with his questions, because he's still behind despite all attempts for me to rig his questions for him to catch up.
Whoa, hey.
Wow. Hold on a second.
He is
judge.
The score is 11-9. And the way we format this is there's four questions with five possible points, and it'll go to Elliot first this week, and he'll get a chance to answer the first question. If he gets it incorrect, then it'll go to Paul and Alex, and you guys will get your chance to answer it, and then Paul will start the second question, etc., etc. 11-9, Elliot's going to start. Elliot is in the lead. I'm going to give you a chapter name of a Stormlight chapter, a random chapter name. You have to give me a brief summary of what happened in that chapter. Paul and Alex, if Elliot gets this incorrect, feel free to collaborate. Elliot, your Stormlight chapter name is Rhythm of the Terrors.
Rhythm of the Terrors. I think this is the category of quiz questions I've gotten the least amount right.
I think we've gotten two successfully between the two of you.
Yeah, out of the 20 quizzes we've done so far. Not a good odds. Rhythm of the Terrors. So, well, the obvious direction to go is Rhythm of War. There's a lot of talk in that book about rhythms and songs that the singers and the listeners can tune into. Rhythm of the Terrors. This is, yeah, confidence is low, but all that's sticking in my mind is Raboniel and her daughter, who's like insane, like very, very insane. And Raboniel's just trying to bring her some peace and is finally able to bring her that with the magic that her and Navani discover. Maybe there's a chapter in there where she's like attuning to the rhythm of the terrors. See, now I'm being too specific. The strategy here is to stay vague. That's my answer.
Incorrect. Paul and Alex.
Alex, first I'll fill you in that these are never what you think it is. So think of your top guess. then go down like three or four guesses before you start, you know.
And then be as vague as possible, because then I'll give you the point.
Yeah. This involved some of our characters in the Stormlight Archive. And there was
rhythms.
Yes.
In this chapter. Probably okay. Some terrors.
Perhaps. My guess off the top of my head is that there's a scene at the end of Oathbringer where, okay, you're going to bear with me a little bit. I think I can describe this, but my specifics may be rocky. I think there's a scene at the end of Oathbringer where there's almost like a line of singers or listeners or whichever one they are, kind of in the background of the big fight going on. And they're doing their little like rhythmy singy thing that's almost like a little war chant for all the fighting and stuff going on. There's like a line of them, and isn't it, I think it's like Lyft or someone who goes and tries to like wipe them out, or someone tries to go like interrupt them. That might be in Rhythm of War and not Oathbringer, but I think it's at the end, nearest to the end of Oathbringer. That's the only guess I can think of. I'm also metagaming a little bit because I've read The Way of Kings. I don't think it's that, and I'm reading the beginning of Words of Radiance, and I don't remember this chapter name, so I think it's got to be later. But this is knowing the logic of how these always go, Alex.
See, I have a different guess.
Absolutely, and yours is probably more likely to be right. I was going to say, given the gist of this, it's going to be where this is like a chapter where it's Shallan just talking to, I don't know, Kaladin about, it's going to be the boots chapter or something where she steals his boots or something like that. Yeah, it's going to be that. What's your guess? What's your thought?
My guess is that it would be something in Oathbringer, and it's a chapter where I can't think of anything specific, so I'm just going to play that vague card. I feel like it's something with Dalinar, and he's like adjusting to a or he's not adjusting, but he's like, it's part of his journey of trying to come to grips with his past and like starts remembering his past. And I feel like it's maybe like an aftermath of that, something to do with him just like trying to reconcile, that was the word, trying to reconcile with his past. So that's my guess.
It's a pretty good guess.
All three of you are incorrect.
Okay,
that's fair.
Yeah, classic.
Paul, the scene that you're fabricating in your brain is at the end of Words of Radiance, and they're summoning the Everstorm, and Adolin is the one who cuts through the hill and attacks them from behind and tries to stop their singing.
So I wasn't fabricating it. I was just wrong on the location and
on every detail you could have had. Yes.
Like I said, don't count me on the specifics.
Oh, sorry. But I'll grade you with a curve next time. Okay. This is the chapter right before the chapter name Invasion. And this is Venli and Raboniel running through the bottom of Urethiru and about to take it over. And Venli kills her first person, and it kind of freaks her out, and they're about to take over Urethiru in Rhythm of War. Also, there's a random scene where Kaladin is in like a therapy depression group, and he's like helping some guys through depression in the same chapter. No points there. Paul and Alex, this next question goes to you. I'm going to give you a quote. You need to tell me who is speaking. Okay? This is a verbal quote, not like an internal dialogue. Is there a place where people live in gouges in the ground? A city built in an enormous complex of lines, all set into the rock, as if carved there?
You can talk out loud.
No, we're conferring. We're a team here.
Doesn't want Elliot to hear.
Yeah. Sure. Which I used to go by that strategy, but now I'm like, I just have to verbally process. So there's Elliot's just going to get to hear whatever I'm thinking, and that's fine. What were you saying?
I feel like it's something in Edge Dancer where she goes to the city, and I don't remember its name, and I don't remember her friend's name. What?
Wendell?
Gwendol.
It's just
Wendell. Sorry, there's no G. Wendell. I was thinking of Glorf. I feel like it's
Glorfindel for the Tolkien people.
Hey. Lord of the Rings reference?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I feel like it's either Lyft or Wendell talking about, because they go to a city that's
all sunken in.
All sunken in.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't remember. It's been a minute since I've read Edge Dancer. My train of thought was Shallan in Words of Radiance when they're like in the chasms. But let's go with that, because I don't have much faith in my guess. So I'm going to do the thing that I apologize to all of our listeners. Trevor, can you read the quote one more time?
Of course. I'd be disappointed if you didn't ask. Is there a place where people live in gouges in the ground? A city built in an enormous complex of lines, all set into the rock as if carved there.
That sounds too eloquent for Lyft.
What about Wendell?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Oh, okay. It might be Wendell, maybe.
Well, see, but now this but is all that I can think of. Could, I can't think of anything
it
else.
It could be Lyft. I'm also just on this train. I don't know.
Right. I'm not being like roadblock where I can't think of anything else. I'm gonna stick to my guns because that was my first guess.
You think it's Lyft?
Probably no, Wendell.
Okay, we'll go with Wendell. Final answer.
Which I could be super wrong, but I'm sticking to it.
Incorrect.
Yeah, okay. Sir.
That's all right.
Elliot?
I have two ideas about this, and they're very different, completely different scenes with none of even the same characters there. So I have to pick one and go with it. I'm not going to verbally process it, though, because I think there's a follow-up question coming when I get this wrong. So my guess is actually Kaladin.
Wow. That's correct.
Wow.
So, all right. Who's he talking to, Elliot?
Is he talking to Shallan?
Oh, who is he talking to? Well, so I can tell you why I think he's asking this question. So remember the scene where Kaladin like has a dream and he flies over Roshar and visits all the places? That's what I thought of when you read this. Like, did he fly over that city that's in Edge Dancer that you guys are thinking mm-hmm. about, but then comes out of it and he's like, whoa, is that real? And he's trying to figure out, what did I see? And then he asked that question. Who's he asking it to, though? I mean, the Stormfather? I don't think it's Stormfather. It's probably, who would he be talking to? I don't think Shallan's even there yet.
Sigzil.
Oh, yeah.
He's asking his world singer, Bridgman buddy, who used to study under Hoyt. And the reply is, yes, Sesimelic Star. It is the capital of the kingdom of Emuel, and it is one of the most ancient cities in the world.
Oh, see, the thing is, now I remember that conversation, because it's like, isn't it? I actually had a minor tangent. I was starting to think maybe something with that will come up in Stormlight 5 or Era 2 of Stormlight, because it's deemed as like one of the most, like, it's like the ancient city and on Roshar. So I'm like, surely there's something there. Anyways, I do remember that now.
All right. That is 1-0 to Elliot. Elliot, you get everyone's fan favorite question. I'm going to read you a review of a Cosmere book that you have read. You need to tell me what they rated it out of 5 and what the book is. So here's the review. To say I was a little let down was an understatement. Apart from his short novels, I've happily read all of these BS books. Some were good.
Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah.
Some were good, some were not. The Mistborn series are by far his greatest works. I had such great hopes for this, and for about 80% of the book, it was. Then the end came. There was nothing overly wrong with it, but it just seemed really, really rushed. Up until then, there was a great deal of buildup that I imagined would be amazing to see come to a climax. But it just like ran out of paper and had to cram another 20 chapters in the last 2. My biggest issues are the answers. We were given far too many too quickly. While as a reader, it can be frustrating to have to wait, Wheel of Time, I'm looking at you, having that wait makes finding them out much more rewarding. Yes, there are loads of new questions asked to be and to be answered in those to come. But really, did we have them? Do we have to ask them all at once?
That's a lengthy one, which I feel like is a good thing because there should be more clues in there, but then maybe also just misleading because they're rambling on about stuff. I can draw a few conclusions though. Although again, we've talked about how logic and crazy reviewers on Goodreads or wherever you get these from don't always mix. They like Mistborn and they reference it as if this book is not that. So there's half the Cosmere. Then they think the end is rushed. I think this might be, I'm gonna go out of left field a little bit. Normally these are Stormlight, but I think you've maybe picked another. I think this might be Warbreaker, because I think the end of that book does get a little bit rushed and a lot of things kind of pop up at the end of that book. And you're left with a lot of questions that it very much is set up for a Warbreaker too. There's a lot of things we need to go back and revisit there. So I think maybe they struggled with Warbreaker a little bit. Now, what did they rate it? This is probably a boring 3 out of 5.
Paul and Alex?
Okay. Alex was over here whispering that she thinks she knows it, so I'm going to see what she has to say first. I have an idea, but I'll come back.
Immediately, my first thought was also Warbreaker, but I wouldn't have been surprised. I won't be surprised if it's maybe Elantris. Just because when I read it, I felt very much like that was what happened. But I also know that their thoughts on the ending are the general thoughts on people's ending on Warbreaker, which, fun fact, prior to Tress, Warbreaker was my favorite Cosmere novel. So I'm still a Warbreaker. But yeah, Warbreaker was my first guess.
I thought about Warbreaker, and I specifically think it is not Warbreaker. And don't ask me for reasoning. I just don't think it's Warbreaker. I did. My guess was going to be, my initial guess is Elantris. Mm-hmm. The ending does feel rushed. And that or The Way of Kings. I think it's something that they've read Mistborn and they're picking up something else by Brandon Sanderson. And something that they're saying you didn't have to wait for the payoff and all the questions are answered. That kind of rules out Stormlight for me, because while a lot happens in a fairly short amount of time at the end, there's a lot of buildup to it. So I don't think that's why. So my vote would be Elantris. Are we good to agree on that, you think? Or do you think it's Warbreaker?
Oh, we'll go together. We'll do Elantris. I still think it's Warbreaker, but I will go with you and do Elantris.
Okay. I think it's Elantris. The numbers part is always the wild card here of... He says he doesn't, he almost liked it. I'm synopsisizing it, summarizing it. That's the right word.
No, let's go with synopsisizing.
Yeah, I agree. Synopsisizing the review. He said he almost liked it. The end felt rushed. Not as good as Mistborn. I'm guessing he probably would have rated Mistborn a 5 out of 5. Can you read like the first 2 sentences? Because he talks about why he rated it what he did at the very start. I won't make you read the whole thing because it was long.
Apart from his short novels, I've happily read all of these BS books. Some were good, some were not. The Mistborn series, by far the greatest works.
Okay. Which I was trying to remember.
As a side note, it's a beautiful use of language by that reviewer. Incredible.
I was trying to remember the context he used. He referenced short novels. I was trying to remember if this was him saying this was a short novel. He just said he hasn't read the short novels, which I assume is like Edge Dancer, Emperor's Soul, stuff like that is my guess. But anyways, I think this is Elantris. What do you think? What do you have any ideas? I think it's like a 3 out of 5 or so as well.
What? Well, yeah, that's my guess too. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a 4 out of 5, but I'm thinking 3 is the most logical.
I think it could be anywhere from 2 to 4. I could think of 2
or or 5. Yeah.
The thing that we've learned with these reviews is whatever, like they'll absolutely bash. Someone will be like, "This is the worst book I've ever read," four out of five or three out of five or something like that. Or like Brandon Sanderson has done it again. This is a masterpiece, 3 out of 5, you know, something like that. So you never really know. I think we'll go with
three. That's like it might be a 4, but we'll go with 3.
We'll go 3 out of 5 for Elantris.
Alex and Paul, you will be pleased to know that it was neither Elantris or Warbreaker. So your decision did not have a big difference. It is a 3 out of 5. So both of you get a point. For Words of Radiance. Apparently they had all their questions answered by the end of Words of Radiance.
Words of... See, this is... Like we said, the logic thing. Oh, I had so many questions at the end of Words of Radiance.
You deliberately ruled out Stormlight because of this review.
And if it was Stormlight, I was like, I could see maybe the Way of Kings, like they're picking it up. But like end of Words of Radiance, you have Nightblood and Nail who fly out of the sky, heal Zeth from the dead. Next question.
All right. It is 2-1 in Elliot's favor. This goes to the trivia question led by Paul and Alex. What nation on Roshar declares itself to be on the side of the listeners by the end of Oathbringer? Yes, you can look at your map.
Yeah, I don't think we can.
Okay.
I'm cutthroat with this. I'm assuming this is around the time that they like reveal the big note, the big historical note that the listeners were the first there, that were the void, that the Alethi are the void bringers.
Do you want me to verbally process?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The Nohaka.
We either get it right or Elliot probably gets it right. He's thinking, but
wasn't it the nation that has the other herald as their like god king? I can't remember what nation it is.
Paul doesn't even remember that to begin with, it looks like.
Yeah,
I'm not.
Yeah, that one. What was the name of that one again?
You tell me so that I make sure that you're right.
Yes. Which herald?
I don't know. It was the one that went crazy. Well, they all went.
Yeah. Glad we're eliminating suspects here.
Because I'm like, naturally, I would think to like Shinovar is usually the one to do other stuff, but it couldn't be because we haven't really talked about Shinovar at all.
I know it's not Shinovar.
I doubt it's Carbranth. Do you think it'd be Taravangian with Carbranth? I don't think so.
It's not him.
It's probably not Yakoved. They're not really in the playing field.
Carbranth is, I thought.
I think they're different. Because Carbranth is led by Taravangian, Yakoved is Rishlan's from.
That's right. I'm so sorry. You're correct.
So what? We have like Eerie. We have...
Which they're part of it too. They're part of the Alliance. That's why I think it's the God King people. I just don't know their name.
Can you describe... Do you know anyone who's from these people?
We haven't really interacted with anybody. But I think in Rhythm of War, they're at war with these people. I think. Or they're... I still think it's the God King people, but I just can't remember their name.
Is it just like Kolinar or something? Because Dalinar is being a good guy. Mm-mm. You said which country, right? Like which
nation is which the nation? Wording I used.
Very convinced. I believe you. What are they called? Who are the God King people?
I will accept that as an answer, and you are incorrect.
Okay. That's fair. Just way to cut that one off right there.
Yeah. Welcome to trivia.
Yeah. No, it was probably better for him to cut that off before we just keep going.
That's true. Is
it?
Yeah.
Okay, to catch everyone up, we just lost Elliot's internet. Paul and Alex were incorrect with their guess. Elliot, go ahead and give your guess.
My guess, I liked where Alex's logic was going. I think it is the God King, who I think is Ishar, and I think he's with the nation of Emuel. And they're fighting against the heroes on the side of the singers.
Okay. That is... I believe you're correct that it is Ishar and Emuel, but that is incorrect. The real answer is fascinating. So when Dalinar is creating his little coalition, he gets a direct no from the Irialli. And by the end of Oathbringer, the Irialli are directly aligned with the Singers. And the fact that they show up in Mistborn Era 2 is then an interesting question.
And on Tress, apparently. Although we don't know where that is in the timeline.
And on Tress.
Yeah, we'll have to wait till the end of the book, apparently, for Mr. Trevor to spill the beans.
Yeah. Alrighty. That puts it to 2-1 for Elliot. Elliot, you get the point for a grand total of 12-9. I will update the score. Thank you for joining us, Alex. We will have you on again, if you'd like, for the Tress wrap-up episode, which we'll be doing probably in 5 weeks from now or so. It was a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed getting to be on. I mean, I've been with Paul several years now, and so getting to actually get to be a part of it has been really cool. So thank you.
Do you just hear a one-sided conversation from the other room when he's recording podcast? My wife always complains about that. Like, I was trying to follow along from the podcast from the other room, but I can never do so because she only hears my side.
Yeah, well, it was hard because when we, in the house that we lived in previously, there, it was a small little cottage, and so there weren't really like walls, and this was before you guys were doing books that I hadn't read yet, and so I had to be super careful. Like, I always had earplugs in for the entire time you guys were doing it because I didn't want any spoilers, and there would be every now and then I would hear, it was when you guys were doing Mistborn, I'd be like, Seiza did this, I'm like, no. So thankfully having walls and doors has helped quite a bit. But yeah, it is always interesting hearing just the one-sided conversation.
And Alex is basically about caught up or ahead of mm-hmm. me and Elliot now. So she doesn't have to worry too much about being spoiled anymore.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Paul, Elliot, and Alex. And we will reconvene next week.
See ya.
Ciao.